at the church, we are almost coming to the end of what we have been wrestling with over the past couple of Sundays, which is this idea of how do we frame the year 2023 as we get into it, so that it's the year that God has imagined and created it for to be for you and I. And so we have been thinking about what are like the frames that we can position on the sides of this year so that then we live fully and with freedom within it. So we talked a lot about the idea of consecrating ourselves, about the idea of trusting ourselves in God. Blessed is a man who trusts in the Lord. They are like a tree planted by the streams of river, you know. We talked last week about unlearning and relearning, which is like the whole thing. And then today we want to spend some time talking about a Christ-centered life. Like, would 2023 for you and I be framed by how well we are centered in Christ in all sorts of areas and all sorts of ways, you know? And this has been really, just because you hear Christ-centered, you know, life, and you just almost as a Christian come up with ideas and images of what that could look like. It's just being wrestling with how can I communicate to you in a way that is fresh, in a way that moves you actually to do something with this other than just some cool message. So as a part of wrestling with that, I remembered, because my wife is away for some work-related things, so, and they are like these three little children. So I remembered, you know, the first time that she had to go away for work-related something. Our little one at that point was just, I think, 8 months. This is Rudo, like the first one. So this is our first baby, and like about just 8 months, you know, and she's about to go away for like a week or so. And we had a house help who was coming during the day. So then nighttime was my duty, you know, which means that it was my job to put the baby to sleep, make sure the baby sleeps through the night, because it's most scary for the baby to wake up at 2 a.m. and realize the mother is not there, you know. And so it was, of course, you know, very, very big deal. And I was just there walking around like I can do this, but Mudhoni couldn't trust me. So she walked me through all sorts of things that are helpful. You know, if the baby does this, you do this. If they, you know, everything was sorted. And finally, she boarded the plane and off she left, you know. And I was thinking about that initial times, because one of the things that she brushed off, or at least we learned that I was revisiting this week, is a fascinating concept that women, mothers, you know, it's almost like baked within motherhood. It's like this idea that there's a particular way that mothers actually handle their children. It looks like they just do it and it's everything, but it turns out, like research has shown, that most mothers, whether you are light-hearted or left-hearted, you take your baby and somehow you candle them on your left side. Like almost like you place them like on your, you know, on top of your heartbeat as it were, you know. And this is like something that people have been intrigued with. But because like if you are, you know, it should be like automatic that depending on which hearted you are, right or left hearted, you take the baby and candle them either on the left or the right side. But over and over, it's just this instinct within mothers that we just candle our babies on the left side up above, you know, where our heart is beating. So I guess this, I don't know whether this is the thing that started it or the other thing, but they did some more, you know, and exploration of this whole concept of the power of the baby resting on the mother's left side, like almost the power of the baby resting above the mother's heart, as it were, and listening to this. And so they figured out that, you know, towards the last semester, the baby gets to learn, the baby is mature enough to identify the mother's heartbeat, so in the womb, you know. So they say that most of the last trimester, this baby is being locked constantly to the rhythms and the drumming of the mother's heartbeat, you know. So that then by the time they come into the world, they almost carry this memory of this mother's heart sort of beating, you know, on and on and on and on. But they push this a little bit further. As a matter of fact, because we like to do all sorts of researches, we learn that this is a really big deal. That about 30 years ago, this guy reports, this is some scholar, Noboru Kobayashi, some article he writes, he says that over 30 years ago in the States, there was a study conducted where they recorded the heartbeats of healthy mothers and played it for babies in the nursery. And it seems that those babies who had the heartbeat recording cried less and slept better. That furthermore, when compared with the babies who did not hear the recording, they also had better development as far as weight was concerned. Like there has been a similar study, of course, conducted in Japan, and it gave up the basic. So almost simply saying that this thing that mothers across the world, that almost they do instinctively, almost seems like it's actually, of course, we carry more knowing that we are aware of that. Actually, it means something that babies get to rest better when they can sense the mother's heartbeat, you know, when it's healthy. That mothers get calmer. They feel that sense of, like that sense of safety permeates to their child when they can sense the mother's heartbeat. But not only that, it has to have like very tangible implications of that, you know? That as they go on, they just get this sense of like, and it doesn't matter whether it's like the real heartbeat or literally a recording of the heartbeat. So I mean like, with this, I've been thinking a lot about this whole concept of like these babies who respond in a particular kind of way, not because of anything the parent does or doesn't, not because of anything the parent is giving or not giving the baby, simply because the kid gets connected to the heartbeat of the mother. That if they can sense that heartbeat, they literally reorient their lives and see the world a little bit differently. And it's almost like even if we just could just capture the recording and just keep playing it for the baby will be as fine as it gets, you know? And this whole idea for me was just this sense that as we grow old, of course, like this illusion that we are supposed to live like self-determined, independent, completely off, right? But the truth of the matter is, like it's almost like a hint that whatever it looks like, we are created to live centered lives. And what I mean by living centered lives is simply there's always a thing, not just within us, but most of the time, like outside of us, that is can be like the basis, almost like the heartbeat to which we move our lives to. You know, we are created to live centered lives. That almost like as God created you and he breathed life into you, almost like you keep longing for this breath, that this thing that comes from outside of you. And that thing that comes from outside of you, in this case for the baby, is like the mother's heartbeat. That thing can literally shape how you show up in life, how calm you feel, how safe you feel. And you do realize that there's like literally like this baby can be assumed that the baby is alive, the baby is well, the baby is eating, so the baby doesn't even need the mother anymore. No, it turns out that if the baby can find a centering in the mother's heartbeat, and if the mother's heartbeat is healthy, it has all sorts of implication that elevates the power of what is already happening in the baby. So we are created to live this sort of center, like lives centered to something. Most of the time, outside of ourselves, you know? But we get to live, of course, the longer we live, it almost feels like that is something that you just move on from. Like you don't even notice it. Like you don't notice there's a heartbeat that you're clamoring. There's a heartbeat that you keep leveraging and lending your ear to over and over. And of course, to get this little going, I came back to this story. Like almost like an obscure detail that is thrown in this really powerful moment. It's Jesus has just finished washing the disciples' feet. He's just there, and it just seems like now that he has washed their feet and they are sitting down around whatever the table, it's almost like his mind starts to wander around, and he starts getting concerned about the upcoming betrayal and his crucifixion, you know? And he just almost like start talking. I mean, it's like such a trajectory from just washing our feet and the whole movement and how powerful that is, to then shift from there and just start talking about us. One of you is going to betray you, you know? And so, of course, the disciples are taken aback. They're like, what is that about? And then we get this glimpse of a moment. And in this context, we read, as Agi has told us, that as Jesus was saying this idea that there's some person who is going to betray him, and that almost like the end is about, you know, he very truly I tell you, one of you will betray you. Of course, you can imagine the disciples, like, this is, whoa, we just washed our feet. Now, what do you mean betray you, you know? And so they looked at one another, uncertain of whom he was speaking. Now, one of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, that beloved disciple, was reclining close to his heart. It's like, you know, was reclining close to his heart. And clearly it's not Simon Peter, because Simon Peter looks at this guy who is close enough to Jesus and says, you know, to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. So while reclining, again, that reclining, while reclining next to Jesus, he asked him, Lord, who is it? And so Jesus answered, it is the one whom I give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dead. And it's, of course, easy to move on to the next, you know, part of how this story of dipping of the hands in the dish unfolds. But before we get to that, like, this is like, this part is all I want to draw our attention to for our time together. And some people have argued that, you know, more Christian iconographers and photographers have done a better job recapturing and bringing this image back to the centrality of our faith than theologians, because it is so subtle, it's so easy to miss it. So they have done all these different images of this beloved disciple leaning on Jesus. You know, and a fascinating thing about this is, like, we tend to forget a lot that at this point Jesus is just barely 33 years old. You know, an older guy who's just there with wisdom or whatever. So he's a 33-year-old guy, surrounded by a bunch of at least early 20s or late teens. You know, so it's literally a gathering of, like, just young people as they hang around sort of this table, right? So you have this icon of, like, this beloved disciple, and then we have these people keep being imaginative, and one of the worst ones I saw was this one. It captures what I want to do, but, like, seriously, if you're, like, 18 and you have that much hair on your, you know, thing, all right, for, hey, okay, you know, and then Jesus just looks like grazed eyes or whatever. But stay with me here, because I think, like, we need to reclaim this moment, this image. And I don't want to even you remember the text. I want to remember this image, that this disciple is reclining on Jesus's heart. It's like either reclining next to him, but they capture it almost to say that he's reclining on Jesus's, you know, heart, as it were, which, of course, if you connect it to what I've just talked about, you know, children and infants and leaning on them, you start getting to see that there might be something going on here more than what we want. So the beloved disciple is just reclining, is just resting on Jesus's chest, as it were. And from this place of, however this image looks like, it's just a place of intimacy. It's just like this place where it's just like so much intimacy just flowing in between these different people. And some people have argued that, as far as John might be concerned, that the Jesus, the beloved disciples at this point are just hearing the heartbeat of Jesus in the midst of all these different things. And from this place of hearing this heartbeat, he's looking out into the world. That is, he reclines and he's hearing Jesus' heartbeat. It's not like his eyes are closed out in some sort of, like, romantic movie kind of a thing. He's just looking out, you know, he's just hanging out with these people, which means he gets to see the disciples around the table from this privileged position, from hearing the heartbeat of Jesus to looking out of the world, I mean, out to the world from this particular view. And some have argued that this is John's basic understanding of what discipleship is meant to be. You know, the thing we talk about, how do we become more oriented to Christ? How do we become more like Christ? How do we become formed in Christ-likeness? And some argue that John's understanding of whatever that process looks like, it's simply getting to this place where we are the ideal disciples, the one who is attuned to Christ's heartbeat. Is the one who hears what is really beating in Christ's heart. And then not only hears what is really beating in Christ's heart, but then sees the world from that place with that sound resonating within them. That's Ron Rohiza who argues that. And so you get this sense that in this just obscure image, there's like so much going on, that this guy is just literally like just hearing the heartbeat of our Savior, of the Christ the Lord, of the one from whom everything flows, which means he gets to sense almost the cares, the tension. Remember the recording of the mother's heartbeat? They say if the mother is healthy, their heartbeat then is normal, in a sense. Almost like you can sense the tension that the mother is carrying from the way the heartbeat is beating. So this person, as they lean into Christ, as they just rest on his breast, as it were, they get a feeling for what is Christ's heart really beating for. And not only is it important to hear and get a sense of that heartbeat, but it's also that becomes a place from where we go and see the world out. And so, like, the question I really want to wrestle a little bit here with for each one of you, because we are living a version of our lives centered on some version of heartbeat. It's almost a question of what is your heartbeat, the one that you are listening to, the one that you are attuned to. What is a heartbeat then give you? I mean, what kind of sight is it giving you to look out into the world through? You know, so you get the sense of this invitation to intimacy with Christ. It's like this invitation to intimacy with Christ. That's what will give you a sense that as this baby is like resting, sensing the safety that comes from the heartbeat of the mother. It just almost gives a new understanding of this idea of come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened. It's just like come across the table. And come to this intimate place. Come to this place where you literally can sense what my heart is beating for. And if you could allow what my heart is beating for orient you, perhaps you leave from my place as a rested person. That this is an icon of peace. It's like literally a child is a mother's breast. It's like, save. This child is rested. This child is contented. This child is calm. This child is free of tension. This child is not wanting to be anywhere else. They just rest there until all they do is just have their eyes fall asleep. I mean, their eyes close instead. You know, this is an image of primal intimacy, of this oneness with Christ, of this deeper connection that even romantic love. It's a connection that is beyond what our popular understandings of what this might have to be. It's a way that is shaping you either to sleep or to get up or just to see the world as a safe place. Remember, this baby is born into the chaos that is unfolding in front of their eyes, into all the running around in our world and like the house itself and people are caring, whatever. And then the baby comes to rest on the mother's heartbeat and automatically just gets a sense of like, all is well. There may be all this chaos going on around me, but for as long as I can hear my mother's heartbeat, I can just breathe, I can rest, I can sleep. This is a question. What is it? Which heartbeat beats for you to go to sleep? Is it like from a place of like rest, from a place of I am held, from a place of the world is safe, from a place of regardless of all the chaos going on around me, in this one intimate place, all is well. All is well even when everything doesn't seem to be well. So invited to come to this place of primal intimacy. But I think in addition to this idea of the baby resting, like what I really wanted to give to us is sort of an image, like to as an invitation to live our lives centered on Christ's heartbeat in the midst of all the other heartbeats that we have going on around us. This is really for two main reasons. And one of them is that from this place of sensing, being so intimately attuned and in touch with Christ that we sense his heartbeat, is a place from where we get an alternative vision for life. I don't know what your vision for life is, but most of the time our visions for life tend to be a bit slightly distorted. They start to be slightly mad with all sorts of different things. But when we come here, we can get a vision. And that's what I'm really hoping for you as you go into 2020, that you keep getting and bumping into what is the alternative vision for life here, apart from the predominant vision being sold to me, separate from all the visions that I may have inherited on what this year could be like. So what does this vision look like? That when we are listening to Christ's heartbeat and looking at the world from this place, we get to see what it means to love, what it means to love well, what it means to love purely. That we get the sense to love despite the harsh world that we live in. That we get to love, to love within the harsh world that we live in with all its temptations to hate. To love beyond the binaries that exist all around us. The binaries of you belong, you don't belong. You are one of my tribe, you are not one of my tribe. You voted the right way, you did not vote. Like this endless sort of binary. You are single, I'm married. This endless binaries that keep curtailing our love. So we get to get a vision from Christ, what it looks like to love beyond all sorts of binaries that exist everywhere you look. To love beyond ours and others' opinion. Do you know how good I am at telling myself stories that stop me from loving my neighbor? They have a wall. They are never home. But in this place, like, I get to see, get a vision, at least from Christ, who was able to love beyond almost his and others' opinions. That we get to love, not depending on the lovability of the person that we are attempting to love, but to love them in spite and despite of their lovability. That from this deep, intimate place, we get to have a vision of self-sacrifice. Remember, Christ is literally about to offer himself up for all that is broken in the world. We get to get a vision for self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice beyond our comfort, which is our God, especially those of us who inhabit urban spaces. Comfort is our primal God, right? But we get to love beyond our comfort, to love beyond our ambitions. I mean, rather, self-sacrifice beyond our own ambitions. Self-sacrifice beyond our culture's temptation to pursue the immediate, to pursue the false, to pursue the destructive. We get to get a vision for self-sacrifice to pursue something that is deeper, something that is more meaningful, something that is more long-range. So that's what I mean when we say, when we lean and we lean on Christ to an intimacy that we can sense his heartbeat, what we get is a vision for how to live this life. And I think that we are all desperate for a vision. I mean, given the amount of effort and energy that we pour into trying to figure out what is the purpose for being here, whatever, it's all this a way of saying, I am desperate for a vision. The problem is the world gives you a particular vision. Your tribe gives you a particular, your gender gives you a particular vision. Your workplace gives you a vision. Of all these different visions, with all their ups and downs, their, you know, shadow sides and happy moments, there is still remains an alternative vision from where we can see. The greatest call is not to be more ambitious, it's to self-sacrifice, to offer ourselves as a living sacrifice for the sake of others. The first thing I want to invite you, or to try to say that this matters, is because then we get an alternative vision for what it looks like to live through 2023. That not only do we get a vision when we are this intimately connected to Christ, we also get empowering. That we get to sense the intimate heartbeat of Christ. And just the same way that the mother's heartbeat empowers a child to sleep in safety, to calm down regardless of what is going on, we literally also get a sense of empowering for the kind of life we need. And I don't know about you, but I'm desperate for empowering. I almost know how to live the life a lot of the times. What I lack most of the times is the power to live it. So there is the blessing, the gift of empowering. The guy I quoted before, who is a Christian, Christian writer and priest, says this, that when we are listening to Christ's heartbeat, when we are feeling his comfort and looking at the world from this particular place, we will also more easily find the strength to keep our hearts soft when everything beckons us to be hard. We get the strength to keep our hearts soft when everything beckons us to be hard. We'll get our tongues to keep our tongues gentle when everything is gossip and slander. Our heart, and to keep ourselves aware of others' gifts when all around us is jealousy. We will more easily find the capacity to forgive despite our own wounds, to live lives of chastity inside an overstimulated culture, to see beauty inside the drum and duty, to see the sacred inside the humdrum, the ordinariness, and to remain aware of God's presence inside a godlessness that sometimes overwhelms us. Can you imagine if you are that kind of a person? Could you imagine if you are empowered enough to have this kind of capacity? That you are the person who takes the first step in forgiveness, not because you have healed from your wounds, but rather even while the wounds are still there, you say, I forgive you. Hard as that is. You don't do that because of who you are. You do that because of the empowering that comes from Christ, from leaning so deeply and intimately into Christ's heart that literally his life starts flowing through you to live a life framed by chastity. Like, we are chaste people. And that's like, and I love the word chaste, although we don't use it a lot, because it moves a little bit just farther from the purity culture. You guys, I don't know if any of you pay attention to some of the research that comes out, but some research came out the other week, and I was like, okay, I don't know whether to be encouraged or to cry. But it says that among the Kenyan people, you know, we adults especially, we at least have 7 different partners. And that doesn't matter whether you are married or single. It's like, for what? So just look around, you know, like, anyway. But of course, it does not apply to anyone of you. Maybe for you, just even if you just have. And it's like funny because when they say 7, all of a sudden, if you have just 1 extra partner, it just looks like you are, man, you are like a Christ follower, right? Just 2. In a society where everybody has 7. But it tells us a little bit of the struggle we have to live lives of sacred faithfulness in intimate love to one another. We are incapable of being chaste people other than Christ coming. And this is happening in a society that is 90% Christians, the last time I checked. It's like some godless secular state. Like, it turns out that even we, while we attend churches, we're still very good. Maybe catching up with the culture. So the idea that we are desperate for empowering is because we are not doing very well generally. That out of this place of comfort, this place where, from where we can look out to the world, we can have our tongues be gentle when everything around us is about gossip and slander, which we have become so good. It's literally legalized that to something that, you know, we have created something that you can buy for $4 billion so that you can keep facilitating the slandering of societies, you know? To be a people of soft hands, soft hearts, hearts of compassion. Most of the times what we bump into is a people so sure of their rightness and their wrongness, that there is no room for softness. I would rather divorce my wife than soften my heart enough to admit I was wrong. And even if she was wrong, maybe she deserves forgiveness. Oh, no, no, no. What the court it is. Our people have given up the capacity to have soft hearts. So when I'm inviting you to live a Christ-centered life, and it's not some nice Christian theory that I want you to live life centered on Christ, just because it makes just not your life, but also the life of the rest of us, a little bit more habitable. It becomes a place where all of us can belong with love. But here is the thing, as much as I've talked about this, and I'm sure you can find endless sermons online about the centrality of intimacy with Christ, with different images, whether that be the image of the vine and the branches, whether that be the image of the solid ground from where you build your house, whatever image, there are like endless images that we keep coming back into this understanding of intimacy with Christ. The thing and the hard truth is we struggle to rest in Christ's intimacy. So though I would just leave it with like an inspiration and in a sense of saying like, this is why this is important. But I also know that that is not enough. So here's the biggest thing that I want to wrestle with. Like, why do we struggle so hard to rest on Christ's breast to sense and hear his heartbeat? Why do we struggle? If we just rested in this place, we'll get that sense of comfort. That says that we are safe even when there is chaos all around us. Why do we struggle? I think one of the greatest ones is that Christ is not the only one in the market offering his heartbeat to be a place of rest. That there are all these amazing other alluring hearts that are also beating. Maybe a little bit louder, maybe a little bit more dramatic, maybe a little bit more theatrically, in a way that says, come and rest your ear. Come and rest on me, because from here, you're going to get so much more. And we get a sense of this. I'm just highlighting too. We get a sense of this from Matthew 6:24 to 26. And it says that, again, Jesus talking about that no one can serve 2 masters. And either you serve the one and love the other, or you be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And of course, when it's framed that, like when he says serve money, that sounds awkward, right? Who serves money? And therefore, I tell you, you know, it's like, who serves money? Like, it's like such a melodramatic statement. Like, I don't serve money. Oh, well, until you pay close attention to what heartbeat we pay the most attention to and how that heartbeat shapes how we show up into life. I kid you not. Like, we are in a culture, of course, the economy is bad, and we all walk around with a list of what we would do if we just got just a little bit more money. It's like it just comes natural. And part of it, of course, the economy is struggling and we need to almost think to be intentional with our finances. But on a bigger scale, what starts almost like as an economic level thing, it very quickly turns to be the heartbeat that we listen to most closely, most intimately. And very almost like when no one would ever say that we serve money, you look at the way we have orchestrated and the way we have oriented our lives, and everything simply screams, the most sacred heartbeat you listen to is wherever the ching-ching is. And money is not a bad thing, as it were. It's like it offers an amazing, bumping heart. It tells you, if only you got me, then you can get whatever else it is. So it's not about really money. It's just about trying to live a life. That means that I have a few more material worlds. But then this continues. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, about what you eat or drink, or about your body, what you wear. Or is not life more than food, and not the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they are? And so you have on one level money, but the second one, almost intimately, very close, is worry. Of course, again, no one almost would argue that the biggest thing about my life, the heartbeat that I listen most to, the heartbeat that I'm most attuned to in my life is worry. Again, until you pay a little bit close attention to how we live our lives, to how tightly we hold on to the little we have, because if we let it go, then that's the end of it. And then you look at literally all our sleeping patterns. That is something about how we got to bed that screams more about what we hold sacred and dear to more than anything else. Of course, it's easy to dismiss these two, money and worry. But Jesus comes back at it through another way, this time now through the parable of the sower. And as he's interpreting this parable of the sower about this person who disperses seeds all over the place, he comes back at this and simply says this, that as for what was sown among thorns, one particular thing, right? That is, this is the one who heart hears the word. But the cares of this age, isn't that a bit connected to the worries of this age? The cares of this age. And the rule of wealth, there you have money again. Choke the word and it yields nothing. Again, the Christ still coming back to, these things are rather big deal. Almost like maybe these are my greatest competitor to you listening to my heartbeat, to letting my heart shape who you are. So here is like literally the challenge that I want to throw to you, because these temptations are not going to go away. I mean, 2023, we're just dialing the dial up. And every time you're tempted to do the hard work of listening and leaning on Christ's breast and letting his heartbeat be the heartbeat that shapes how you show up into the world, very quickly money will scream, "Aren't you ignoring me?" Very quickly, the worries of this world, and there is an endless set of that. Whether those worries are yours or another person, there is always going to be endless. So almost like the challenge is going to be, which heartbeat will you give into? Because you have the heartbeat of Christ offered to us that has been beating consistently, inviting you and I to just come and rest on it and let that heartbeat shape everything. But also there have been the heartbeat of money that has been beating throughout the world. There's also still the heartbeat of worry that has been beating, and it's all going to go. You have to make this hard choice. Which heartbeat am I going to lean into? But I don't think that it's only because of competition. I think it's also this, that listening to the heartbeat of Christ calls for communion and intimacy. Listening to the heartbeat of Christ calls for communion and intimacy. And I don't know about you, we really struggle with literally those two words, communion and intimacy. Literally, that way of saying that, it simply calls for a loving, growing relationship. It's simply that. Now, looking at our marriages, there's a reason why we would rather have seven partners as compared to commune and be intimate with one person. It's like way so hard. You have to bump up against the woods. You have to bump up against the unforgiveness. You have to do the hard work long before you see the fruits of that communion and intimacy. And I think we struggle to do this with God because we are generally bad at communion and intimacy. Just starting in our relationships, be they with the people we love the most, be they with the people at the workplace, be they be our spouses, I mean, be they be our siblings. We struggle as human beings. So almost to say, if you're going to listen to the heartbeat of Christ in a way that it shapes you in all these profound ways, you have to do the hard work of getting better at communion and intimacy. You have to do the hard work of getting better at communion and intimacy. And if communion and intimacy in our lived relationships is much more complicated, it gets worse because I feel like the God we were given, the God we like to hold on to, the God that we most adopt, is a God who is more away from communion and intimacy. I mean, to be honest, we prefer a God who doesn't demand communion and intimacy. And that's true of like our cultures. If you go back to the Old Testament, the big reason why the Israelites keep running away from God is because the other gods they have around them, they just demand that you do a certain set of sacrifices and you are good. This God, in some places of the Old Testament, says, like, so mad, like, these people, why do you just keep coming and sacrificing to me as if I need your cows and cattle? Like, what I need is your heart. And that's frustrating for a God who doesn't want just to us to do the right things. Give us the Ten Commandments. I haven't broken any of them. That means that we are good with you. No. This God keeps saying, no, I want more than. That's right. But that also the God that a lot of, it's true of a lot of our tribal cultures. It's a God that you go under a tree when there are no rains and you do your thing and then the rain comes. It's like very quid pro quo, quick God. You know, if that was the God that we had, I think we'd be packed in churches everywhere. Right? If I could just tell you, just give you a 10% and God would answer all the rest of your needs. Like, you will very quickly give 10%, which very few of you do, but I would make it 20% at this point. Right? There's a reason why this very easy, cheap religion answers, like, people clung to it, because it takes away the need to do the painful hard work of communing and intimacy. So maybe the thing that you really need to do is to trade in your God of quick fixes, of quid pro quo, that this is happening in my life because there's this thing going on, and just listen to the God that Jesus reveals, who is the one for inviting us to lean and rest on his bed. Communion and intimacy. It's easy to say, it's excruciatingly hard. Now, when I say communion and intimacy, and then you buffer that up against money and against worry, trust me, we will pick money and worry any day over communion and intimacy. Because I don't know if any of you have attempted to love someone well. Like, the fruits literally show up in all sorts of awkward ways, right? You like love her very, very well. And how that manifests itself, it's almost fast. It's like it takes years and years for the goodness to manifest for both of you. But then too, like when it manifests, not even the thing that you're looking for. Right? The fruit of this intimacy and communion is really frustrating, but God still insists that if you give up on intimacy and communion, then you never get to sense my heartbeat. Then my heart never gets to shape the kind of a person who you are. And because my heart never gets to shape who you become, all these other things get to shape who you become. And what unfolds when all these other things shape who we become? Oh, the writer of the translation, the message in Galatians 5:19-21 gives us a glimpse of what this looks like. And you read this and tell me this isn't what is most manifest and most true in most of our culture. That it's obvious what kind of life develops after trying to get our own way all the time. Almost trying. That's a preacher incoming. See? Has even have a bow tie. Like, better dressed than the current pastor, you know? That this kind of life that develops, and notice the word develops out. It's not like manifests every day. It flows out. It comes out, develops out of trying to get our own way all the time. Almost like what comes out of trying to center our lives anywhere else except for Christ. And what do we get? We get repetitive, loveless, cheap sex. Of course, not true of our culture, that one. We get a stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage. A little bit harsh. We get frenzied and joyless grabs for happiness. We get trinket gods. Gods that just show up and do the things that we want them to do when they need to. We get magic show religion, which is what I'm really considering moving Journey Village towards, right? We get paranoid loneliness. We get cutthroat competition. We get all-consuming yet never satisfied wants. We get a brutal temper. We get an impotence, an incapacity to love and be loved. That's harsh. That the more we center ourselves in heartbeats that are more away from Christ, we become a people incapable, not just of loving, but also of being loved. We get divided homes and divided lives. We get small-minded and lopsided pursuits. We get the vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, into a product, into a commodity. We get uncontrolled and uncontrollable addictions. We get ugly parodies of communities. And I could keep going on. He quotes Paul. Right? Just reflect on that a little bit. Because if that doesn't reflect a bit of how your office place looks like, how our culture looks like, what this kind of research are telling us about the kind of people we are, about some of the horrifying things we get in the news. It's almost saying we are a people who have been listening and attuning our hearts to the wrong, our ears to the wrong heart. And because we have been attuning ourselves to the wrong heart, the heartbeat of that wrong heart is shaping us into these kinds of people. Are people incapable of being loved and of loving? But here's what happens when we orient ourselves to the heartbeat of God. Here's how it unfolds. And again, it's what develops, right? What develops out of this? Like, he brings gifts into our lives, much the same way as a fruit appears on an orchard. It just comes out of many things. Things like affection for others. Things about exuberance about life. Serenity. We develop a willingness to stick with things. A sense of compassion in the heart. Not in the word, not in the mouth, in the heart. And a conviction that basic holiness permits things and people. Like that for me is like the one line that I keep coming back to. That a basic holiness permits things and people. That we find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. I think the greatest crisis we face today is our people incapable of marshaling and directing our energies wisely. And what we do, because we're incapable of any of these things, we just keep lowering the bar and lowering the bar and lowering the bar and lowering the bar, and in the process dehumanizing one another, just consuming one another in ways that leave this place desolate. Is it possible for you in 2023 to choose to be the kind of a person who is doing the hard work of communing and intimacy and relating with God so that this kind of fruit can be birthed from your life? Can you imagine if this fruit shows up at your workplace? And all of us, of course, hope that other people bring this fruit. What if this is the fruit you are meant to bring to your marriage? What if this is the fruit you are meant to bring to your home? What if this is the fruit you are meant to bring to the communities you belong to? We find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. Just that one, marshal and direct our energies. Like, we are done with all addictions. To have a compassion in the heart, to have a conviction that basic holiness permits things and people. Is it even possible? Not even like out there, but even as we gather as a church people, it's so hard to believe that a basic holiness permits every single one of you. It's so easy to see you as a competitor. Because of course you work in this company where people are given serious, serious bonuses as compared to the pastor who has to wait for people not to give their 10%, you know, because he hasn't promised the amazing outcome from this. Now, he's almost like, where I want to learn this. Like, we will keep coming back to this, because I think at the heart of the church is calling people to this, listen, and let the heartbeat of Christ shape them. But here's the thing I want to say. No amount of inspiring conversation from this end are going to stand to be enough to help you do the hard, painful work of saying no to the other tempting hearts, of doing the painful hard work of staying with this communion and this intimacy long enough for this fruit to emerge. But I guess every Sunday we'll gather, we'll do like a start, just an attempt start. And so for today, inviting you to the Lord's table, as I invite the worship team back up, inviting you to the Lord's table is really about charging you to come to this table and to say, is it still possible that as I take this piece of bread and I take this grape juice, that this becomes the body and the blood of Christ taken into me, that Christ's life may pulsate within me. And if Christ's life is pulsating within you, it's also a reflection of Christ's life and Christ's heartbeat starting to slowly but surely shape you. Could we start there today? Just come to the Lord's table as the worship leads us in this next song. And just get some piece of grape juice and some bread, either at the front or at the back. And at the end of this song, we just come and share in the Lord's table together. May we be the people who do the hard work of communing, of figuring out intimacy with the divine, so that this Christ heartbeat may shape who we truly are. Come to the table.